Welcome to Sport Management Review Insights. I'm your host, Vito Silva. Sport coaches often have multiple roles. As well as their training duties and coming up with strategies, they may also act as mentors and community leaders. So in this episode, we're going to discuss the idea of hybrid management in elite sport and how that relates to sport coaches. Joining us to consider this is a researcher who's published several papers on sport coaches and their relationships. He's senior lecturer in sport, exercise and rehabilitation at Northumbria University. It's Edward Hall. Welcome, Edward.
Great to speak with you, Vitor. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure to have someone else from the northeast of England. And every time I speak to you, it's sunny, which is fabulous. Amazing. Yeah. Anyone who thought that the northeast was always grey and cloudy, completely wrong.
Yeah, completely wrong.
Edward and co-authors Shirley Gray, Amanda Martindale, John Sproul, John Kelly, and Paul Potrack recently published Doing Hybrid Management Work in Elite Sport, the Case of a Head Coach in Top-Level Rugby Union. Edward, there's a great deal published about sport coaching and management, of course, and the different areas related to that. Now, how did this paper help our understanding of the area of sport coaching?
I think we set out to make a contribution to addressing some of the longstanding limitations that we've seen in existing knowledge about the realities of organizational life, and particularly about the nature of sports work. I'd say that generally, the prevailing picture that we've got of situated practice is somewhat sanitized, sort of inhuman and unproblematic representation of what we do. Managers, coaches, and leaders are typically portrayed as sort of self-contained or self-sufficient and all-powerful entities within those organizations, and emphasized within this agentic kind of conceptualization of the individual's desirable personality traits, their vision, their charisma. And it's kind of created this totemic illusion that managers or leaders and coaches achieve organization and achieve transformational change through these grand heroic gestures of sort of irresistible persuasiveness. And responding to this, I think we went to the heart of practice to see what actually went on there. And I spent 2 years embedded in the everyday realities of organizational life within this international rugby team. So I think in contrast to this prevailing notion of omniscient and omnipotent heroism, we found that the head coach's doing of hybrid management work was really fundamentally about acting strategically in order to become a prime mover within and amongst other people. And in doing so, she was both a tactician, but also a target of influence. And this involved her recognizing that those she interacted with were themselves thinking and feeling and acting people, had their own interests, their own motives, and they could actively resist or adjust or comply or confound her own efforts to influence and to achieve her organization's goals and objectives.
It makes a lot of sense, this idea of those relationships, and you use relational sociology as your conceptual framework. Can you just tell us a bit more about what that is and how it related specifically in this case?
It's really a collection of sociological theories that share in believing centrally that networks of social relations and interactions between different people constitute, if you like, the very fabric of our social life. So for relationalists, this makes relationships themselves the most appropriate unit of analysis for our social scientific studies. What it drives us to do is to generate richly textured accounts of our, I suppose, the complexities and the relational dynamics of that everyday life that you've just referred to, and in this case of everyday working life. I think what's shared across this genus of different perspectives is a desire to move beyond those familiar analytical dualisms, such as structure versus agency, that have tended to lead scholars either towards the study of the individual or towards the study of society as the focus of the research. And relationalists are essentially interested in the between of those two sort of polar positions. So we view all social action as transaction. And for us in this study, Nick Crosley's contemporary relational theorizing both soundly and persuasively draws attention to the associations and the transactions that networks of people engage in who are interdependent with one another. In particular, I think Crosley's work recognizes how the organization of an individual's networks of relationships, in this case, the patterns of ties and interconnections between people within this rugby team, they generate opportunities for, but also constraints upon, their interactions together. So Crossley's thinking helps to shed light upon the history of past interactions and how that shaped, in this case, the head coach's current practice, but simultaneously, how that coaching practice was shaped by their expectations of having future interactions, subsequent interaction with these stakeholders.
You also use the case, as you mentioned before, of a women's international rugby team. And you said you were embedded. I can imagine that's even more difficult in trying to get them on board in doing this. Was it a difficult thing to do to get yourself in there? And how did that make this a great case study to look at?
Yeah, issues of access are always an interesting talking point in ethnographic research, aren't they? Yeah, this is particularly, I think, the case in work in elite and professional sport organizations. I think somewhat understandably, there's inevitably concerns about allowing outsiders in when there's so much at stake. And when the margins for determining success are often so small as well. So for them, minimizing distractions, maximizing focus on the objectives is often at the forefront of their minds. So having a researcher like me trailing around after them and taking up time with interviews and so on is a big ask. In this case, I was usefully able to draw upon some of my existing connections with some of the gatekeepers in the organization that we worked with to begin conversations about the project. So there was a relational nature of gaining access as well. To answer your question, I think, you know, elite sport offers a really fascinating context for this sort of research. For starters, you know, the head coaching role, as you've explained so eloquently, it's a hybrid role. It's clearly comprised of doing some leadership, doing some management, and doing some coaching. And not just of the immediate team, you know, the immediate players in her charge. This head coach was also a national figurehead, someone whose own work intersected with the work of numerous club coaches, university coaches and team coaches and administrators and organizations across the whole country. I think it's also a place of fascination because it's a place of coming together. You know, there are numerous interacting networks. These were really highly dynamic relationships within a really dynamic context, which elite sport is. And equally in this case, what was fascinating was that none of the coaches or players were employed full time in their roles. So they balanced this. So you had this added intrigue of how their identities and relations within the national team were interrelated with the demands of their day jobs, as well as their personal and family lives. So there was all sorts of things that I thought were particularly interesting about this.
Another really fascinating part of this paper, of this research, is the method you took, methodological bricolage. And that included participant observation, reflective field notes, like say ethnographic studies, semi-structured interviews. Did you listen to the podcast with Lorena Haber on qualitative research methods? Is that how it came about? I'm sure you did that well before that. But you know, how did you bring all this together? I'm flat out doing one of these. So to bring it all together, that must have been just extraordinary.
I suppose the starting point would be to explain that methodological bricolage is it's about combining multiple methods of generating data. So, you know, I've been embedded with this team for two seasons, and there was the standard kind of participant observation that you do with ethnography. But then there was also semi-structured interviews, and we used stimulated recall interviews as well. And then there was ethnographic film. This sort of plurality of approaches was intended to add rigor and breadth and complexity and richness, and have all the knock-on consequences of huge amounts of stress and challenge as well to manage it all, as you've alluded to. But I think what the combination of these approaches responds to is a recognition that the research process itself is a relational process, one that would be shaped by me and by the people in the context of the research setting and how we interacted with one another. So this was quite pertinent and useful in different ways to the research process. At a practical level, I couldn't always be with the head coach. There were boundaries within the research context of a female head coach of a female rugby team that I, as a male researcher, couldn't cross. There are also rules in international rugby that dictate where the head coach and other members of staff are allowed to sit in the stadium at different times in certain competitions. So to be able to have the head coach to wear a wireless microphone, or to be able to film her from across the stadium, still keeping in context her interactions and relationships, meant that I could overcome a lot of the barriers that were presented to me and would have prevented capturing those traditional field notes we always associate with ethnography. There was a lot going on for me to capture in this field. You know, as we might talk about, there was loads of people, lots of interaction. And often this happened across really intense periods of interaction amongst these large groups of people for long hours during the day. So to just have another record of those events, it really helped to reduce the workload that I had to manage when I was in the field. the methodological bricolage, I think it enabled an iterative approach to fieldwork, and it helped me to continuously consider, reconsider, check and challenge the emergent interpretations that I was making of the data across the fieldwork, and then write through as a group of co-authors to the process of writing and preparing the paper for submission itself.
Adding to that is how you go about analyzing what I'm sure is just enormous amounts of qualitative data. So tell us, Edward, what was the secret? What'd you do?
Yeah, it's certainly the biggest data set that I've managed up until that point, at least. There's hundreds of pages of field notes, there's thousands of hours of audio and video footage, and many hundreds of hours of interview data. Beneficially, the frenetic iterative approach to data analysis that we adopted, it meant that the analysis and the generation of data occurred simultaneously, concurrently and recursively throughout the research process, so that I was able to use the emerging analysis, as I've said before, to inform the ongoing data generation that we were engaged in. I suppose to give you a general overview, every evening in the field, I would reread and re-listen to that day's field notes, and I would add summaries of things that hadn't been able to capture at the time. But I'd also add notes during this sort of primary coding cycle that would catalog some of the relationships and the common threads that I started to see in the data. I'd rewatch the video footage and I'd have these notes at hand to remind me of what to look out for, things that I'd noted in my analysis to that point. And this emic analysis, this focus on what was meaningful on the ground, then nudged me to ask some sort of deeper, further questions, which I was able to then explore through the reading and the analysis. The ongoing reading of Crosley and of related scholars like Irving Goffman, you know, helped me to start to see those connections between possible interpretations of the data, theoretical concepts that had connections to them, but also connections to the aims of the study.
After you've analysed the data, what were the key results or the key findings you found?
I think the first point of interest among our findings was that the head coach role was a hybrid role. It not only required our protagonist to be a competent coach on the grass, it also required engaging in strategic leadership and management of the various numerous people that she was connected to. And this brought with it a great deal of complexity, with the coach often wrestling to keep various tensions in some kind of a balance. She was consciously aware that she was expected to be ultimately responsible for providing the direction of the team, and that people would look to her to give them this direction. But equally, she was conscious that the team would be most productive if its members also felt that they had some kind of involvement and connection to the shared mission, to the decision-making process, not just one that was dictated from above by her. What really, I think, is where this work starts to perhaps point towards a horizon in some way. The head coach wasn't just conducting these interactions with people in isolated bubbles. Within the team, each person had their own roles, they had their own relationships, and that meant her interactions were with people who were themselves interconnected. It was a vast network of interaction. And the team, if you like, we could characterize it almost as a web of interrelationships, including various factions and alliances and cliques and clusters. This wasn't just a passive process of observing things and being responsive to them. It was also a proactive and a strategic one. You know, the head coach was keenly aware that the different positions within these interconnected networks would generate various constraints and opportunities for the people who were incumbent there, but also for herself as the head coach. And so with this understanding, the head coach could not only kind of carefully manage the conduct of her interactions with people, but she also sought to influence the configurations of these networks themselves in order to best scaffold her efforts to achieve some of the agendas that she had as an individual, but also the organization that she worked for. And I suppose in terms of another finding, at a practical level of getting people on side and then making things happen, she drew upon the connections that she had spanning various social worlds to inform her everyday practice. For instance, her history as an elite player herself, she played at the highest levels herself, meant that she could kind of empathize with the players and put herself in their shoes. And this informed her decision-making. On one occasion, for example, she decided to publicly share in the emotions of the players after they'd been heavily beaten in the change room. So she cried in front of the team after a particularly heavy defeat. She wanted them to know that they weren't just there to coach, that they genuinely cared about them as people. But she also recognized the risks of showing these emotions. But her experiences, being on the other side of the fence as a player, it reassured her that the pros outweighed the cons in this particular case. I think equally the head coach was able to draw from her experiences of working in her day job. She was a really high profile senior leader in a national public service organization. This helped her how to consider things like staffing issues. And these transferable benefits across these social worlds were also counterpointed by various challenges that came with them. Among them, you know, was trying to generate buy-in from coaches of the different club sides that were in her country to try and support her vision for the game. And these were coaches that worked actually with the players that she had in the national team on a much more regular basis when they went back to their club, but who often had their own ideas about the best playing position for that player or the use of certain tactics, which didn't always align with the best interests of the national team. So ultimately, I think the picture that we developed of the hybrid work of this head coach highlighted how closely entangled the quality of her own work was in the actions of others. She relied on so many other people to do their jobs well in order to make her work more manageable and do her job well. You know, as a head coach, to be able to pick the team, as an example, in time for the allocated competition deadlines, she needed the medical staff to be absolutely on top of their roles to keep her up to date on player availability. And others were equally dependent upon her being enmeshed as they were together in their work. So I think in summary, far from being about this heroic notion of individualistic leadership, we found that hybrid work of the head coach to be this ongoing exercise in collective behavior. And in the face of significant challenges, she was able to purposefully cultivate and manage these nuanced relations with, but also between, more and less trusted collaborators within the network she was engaged in. And she did this through strategic micro-political action that responded in lots of ways to the thoughts, the feelings, and the interests of those that she wanted to generate the buy-in from, but also the time and the space to be able to carry out her agendas and the work necessary to do her job. And we found that this positioned her to sort of maintain an oversight, but also to be able to influence the support, the capital, the resources, and the information that flowed through these networks and pathways to help her to achieve the organization's ultimate mission.
Just in relation to the theory, how did this advance our understanding of relational sociology?
I think this is one of the things that we've done, I suppose, is we provided an empirical case study of how organization is achieved despite relationships always being in motion. And hopefully this serves as a rich example of how the social networks that comprise an organization are generated and operate not as a fixed structural context for actions, but emergently as a result of ongoing interactions. And what we've highlighted is how one person, in this case, the head coach, interacted to position themselves within this complex milieu in such ways that they could shape and steer the nature of that organization. I think particularly considering Crosley's relational sociology, it's really important to expand the empirical application of the theorizing and to deploy this lens as we have in new domains, in this case, in sport. I think as well that in one small area, we've touched upon some findings that may help to extend and further develop some of Crosley's theorizing. In his book, Towards Relational Sociology, Nick Crosley emphasized the impact that our direct interaction has as a set of histories upon our anticipation of future interactions with those same actors. So in other words, Crosley focused on how my previous interactions with you, Vitor, would shape and inform my future interactions directly with you as an individual. What we found in this study, though, was how the head coach drew upon her experiences as a player herself, a player who had interacted with coaches, made judgments about, and reflected upon these experiences and informed how she anticipated interactions with new players now that she was a coach, even when a direct interaction history with these individuals had yet to be developed. In other words, I think what she had learned from her past playing experiences appeared to create a sort of a feel for the way in which others would think and typically react to how she now conducted her role as a coach. And this is a more indirect notion of this temporal trajectory of interaction that Crosley alludes to. So examining further how our perspectives upon the world are formed by our direct and indirect relational histories could be a fertile area to continue to develop Crosley's valuable sense-making lens.
In practical terms, you know, you've been embedded there. There's so many coaches and even just sport managers more generally, they're always looking for advice on how to do best practice. What advice would you give them when they're on that day-to-day coalface working with these groups?
Paul Potchak and I draw upon this paper as part of our teaching at Northumbria University and in our knowledge exchange work and consultancy with coaches and coach educators. And we've used it to help inform some of the ways that we support practitioners to think carefully about the work that they do. So the first thing we talk about is mapping the social terrain. For us, this is about actively reading and considering the interests and the preferences of those that comprise our coaching and our leadership environment. And this not only includes athletes, obviously, but also club officials, other coaches, administrators, parents, sponsors, among a whole host of other stakeholders. And if we're going to influence these other people, it's important for us to identify and consider their views or positions on specific matters or issues, to think about what might happen when we bring people together, what consequences might be, and then how we might navigate and attend to specific relationships within that context. And it's important as well for us to consider how we and our ideas might be seen to represent a challenge or a threat to other people at times. So learning about micropolitics, I think, is key here. The second point is to then get people on side, to generate alliances. And I think this is about how we can make others think positively towards us as a person, as well as towards the ideas, the methods, and the philosophies that we espouse as a coach or a manager or a leader. And getting people on our side, or not, as the case may be, primarily happens in our face-to-face interaction. And it's tied to how other people view our performances, how they view our choices, our knowledge, our experience, and our behaviours. So as coaches, we can utilise individual, but also kind of collective strategies to win, maintain, and then advance the trust and respect that we receive from these other people. So here, learning about impression management is really key. The final thing is about making things happen. We've got to get some stuff done as coaches and managers. And this is about how we bring people who may hold different views and preferences together to work collaboratively towards specific goals and objectives, whether that's in a sport team or an organization, we're all kind of trying to do the same thing, really. And part of this includes how we might encourage others to generate a sense of teamness, togetherness, as well as how we deploy people in particular ways and monitor, assess, and then steer them towards investing effort in certain desirable goals. And this aspect of practice can entail us actively seeking to recruit particular people, making people feel valued, helping people to see the qualities that others might bring into the environment, and at times, inevitably, dealing with conflict and resistance from people. And so again, micropolitics and impression management sort of interleave with one another in being crucial sources of information. So as we sort of summarized in the conclusion to the paper, we've been urging coaches and coach educators to look beyond this notion of insulated dyadic relationships, which is often talked about as this kind of coach-athlete relationship, and look beyond that to examine instead the workings of power and exchange in much larger networks of interrelated actors, because this is the reality of what we do as coaches. It's what we do as sport managers. We work with larger groups of people and they're all interacting with one another. So our advice really to policymakers, to governing bodies and to sport organizations is to embed relational thinking in their qualifications and professional development courses so that we can better support practitioners to become more micropolitically astute and positively influential in their work, because it's going to be beneficial for all.
Sounds like excellent advice, and hopefully the coaches take it on board. It was absolutely fascinating, great insight into this research and into the idea. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much, Rita.
Thanks so much, Edward. And thanks for listening to Sport Management Review Insight. Head to the Sport Management Review website to check out all the latest research being published, including the article discussed in this episode, Doing Hybrid Management Work in Elite Sport, the Case of a Head Coach in Top-Level Rugby Union. That's it for this episode, but of course, there are many more you can listen to on your favorite podcast player. And if you could follow the podcast and give us a 5-star rating, that'd be great too. Until next time, it's bye for now.